Hi, this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, where the intelligence comes from my guests. And in this case, Andrew Coburn, a brilliant journalist, wrote the definitive book on Rumsfeld. He's been covering defense issues. He's originally a Brit and Oxford and all that stuff, but he's covered the Pentagon for decades now, demystifying it. And for people who say, uh-oh, is this about the military-industrial complex again? Is this about war and peace? Isn't it always with us? Not quite. So let me just get your attention with something that came out of Brown University, a very good center they have there, Cost of War, the Center for International Policy, and William Hartung, who's one of the directors of their program, wrote this. But the headline kind of says it all, that up to half of the $14 trillion spent by the Pentagon since 9/11 has gone to war profiteers. By the war profiteers, he means five companies: Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon, and Northrop Grumman. And the thing is so obscene that to get people who basically were operating in a desert environment with the lowest tech and then managing to hijack these airplanes with evidently the cooperation of at least 15 and 19 hijackers were from our big ally in Saudi Arabia. We're not going to go into all that. But the war profiteers, and those profiteers include a whole roster of former generals and admirals who were in the Pentagon buying all this stuff, and now they're there getting the profit. That's what the military-industrial complex is all about. And you cannot understand the American economy. You cannot understand why we can't support education, housing, and everything else. And the spoils of war, power, profit, and the American war machine, is kind of a definitive book on where we are on this. It didn't go away. It's stronger than ever. And then people say, and I'm going to throw it over to Andrew right now, but people say, yeah, but they can't win any wars. And then Andrew, in his book, says, well, the whole point is not to continue to win wars. The point is to make money off the preparation for war. So why don't we begin with that? And maybe you could introduce us to something Alexander Hamilton said about the profit of war and what motivates it that is largely ignored by our big academic and think tank institutions that profit right along with these big aerospace companies from the waging of war.
Hey, thanks, Bob. Yeah, the thing is, it's pretty weird, you know, that the liberals and comedy, even people who decry the war machine and all that and say, oh, isn't it shocking? No one likes to talk about money, you know, as the motivation for all this entire fiasco. And really, it's just common sense. You know, apart from sex, maybe, you know, what is the prime motivation that drives people? It's the desire to make money. And that is why, how else can you explain this $14 trillion or, you know, $7 trillion to the profiteers, as you said, that's been shoveled out since 9/11? And it really, you know, it's, as you said, you know, it explains why we don't have money for healthcare and education. And it also explains why these wars are a bust, or at least are a bust in terms of what people are told they're for. You know, the leaders, the Washington says, oh, we got to go to war for, you know, whatever, so Afghan women can have an education and get rid of Saddam Hussein or whatever other excuses we've cooked up over the years. But the real reason is for them to make money. And, you know, so therefore, as I argue, and as I think is pretty clear in my book, the whole thing's been a really great success. I mean, how can you, you know, how can you argue with success? How can you argue with $7 trillion? I mean, that's a pretty, pretty hefty take-home pay. And it explains why our troops fighting on the ground in Afghanistan were denied, as far as the Air Force could make it happen, denied close air support because the Air Force wanted to use a much more expensive nuclear bomber supposedly protecting, you know, a few soldiers on the ground from 5 miles up. You know, there's all sorts of mad looking decisions.
So you're really saying losing these wars doesn't bother them at all. It's actually an excuse for making more wars. But actually losing the wars is even built into their profit making. They would rather, you mentioned, I think it was the A-10 or something that gives close air support to troops on the ground. And they shun that in favor of a B-1 bomber that you launch from, what, Kansas or someplace. And really what they want is the expensive high tech. And as a result, we actually have a smaller, we're in 800 countries, of course, and we're picking fights everywhere. But actually the potency of the American military has declined while the cost has gone up phenomenally.
Again, yeah, that's exactly right. And the reason is, you know, getting back to the point you made at the beginning, you know, if they really wanted to win wars, if they wanted to be successful militarily, you know, they would be building more weapons. But since the objective is profit, it makes much more sense for them to build very, very expensive weapons where they can lard on, you know, enormous costs, you know, $10,000 for a toilet seat cover, I kid you not. And you do all that, which actually gives them fewer, as they call them, platforms, i.e. weapons, you know, fighters, bombers, whatever, ships, submarines, gives them fewer to fight an enemy with, but gives them much bigger profits, and the system is built that way.
And it's budget time they're thinking about. You quote the head of the Marines when he knew the surge in Afghanistan was going to fail, not do anything. He said, yeah, but it looked good at budget time.
Yeah, they said. They agreed. There was a meeting. I mean, this literally happened. There was a private meeting. I mean, I have a good source on it, where the senior Marine generals are all gathered around, and they were laughing. Trump had just been conned into, you know, okaying a mini surge in Afghanistan. And they were sort of laughing about it, saying, well, this won't make any difference. This won't do any good. But as you said, but it will do us good at budget time. And my source, who was in the room, said he felt so disgusted to hear this, that men would be, you know, some men would die, people would die, men and women would die, just to do them good at budget time. I mean, how foul is that?
So look, the people listen to that and they say, come on, these people can't be so cynical. And the other view is generally, oh, it's the gang that can't shoot straight and they don't know what they're doing, and or they're incompetent, or they picked the wrong wars. But you actually argue something that I don't hear very often. In their own terms, they are a success.
Yeah.
And that's something that's hard. So they don't really believe in the enemy thing. So, for example, and I would like you to go through the high points of your book, because it is really a fresh analysis, and I'm trying to urge people to read it, to get it. Just came, actually, we're recording here on the day it just was made available on its Kindle version, so it's brand new. I got that version late last night and reread it again. But what's so interesting about it is that you have been up close with these people. You've been at their conferences. You've interviewed them. You know the insiders and the whistleblowers and so forth. And what we're really talking about is a culture of corruption, polite, civilized, but really obscene, in that it leads to the death of hundreds of thousands of people, the waste of resources, the destruction of communities. So, you know, war is not a video game. If they could make money off it as a video game, I guess they would do it that way. But it's real. It's ugly. It's harsh. It disturbs everything in the world, including our climate and everything else. The military is a major contributor to that. But you're actually arguing, from having covered these people so closely, that actually what drives them is what Hamilton talked about, private gain. And the most important private gain, aside from the example he was using of Pericles and pleasing a prostitute going to war. But actually, and it was with General David Petraeus, he had this whole incident of turning over his secret black books to his mistress and biographer. But the fact is, you know, the most private thing, after all, is getting money. And that's really what Eisenhower was warning about. And it's just ever more so.
You have to read the book to get the whole examples. But I mean, I point out, for instance, that NATO, the expansion of NATO, we made a promise to the Russians unequivocally in 1990 when they were, you know, pulling back from Eastern Europe, that we would not expand NATO into Eastern Europe. And we did. We broke that pledge. And the Russians, you know, that's been the source of tension ever since. Why did we do it? Because the Lockheed Corporation was pushing to sell F-16s in Eastern Europe, and which could only be done if they were brought into NATO. And Bill Clinton figured it would get him a few extra votes in the Polish community in Milwaukee. I mean, so this, you know, it was just for personal gain, personal profit, that they did this hugely destabilizing move, breaking a, you know, a solemn commitment. That's on the huge scale. And then you know, I don't talk about small things. Well, not small things, but a group of American soldiers on patrol in Afghanistan. They're attacked by the Taliban. This is in 2014. They're attacked by the Taliban. They call for air support. The only air support available is this enormous B-1 bomber designed and built to, you know, fly to Moscow and drop nuclear weapons on the Kremlin. They aren't equipped to actually see who they're supporting on the ground, so they loose off their bombs on what they think is the target and kill five Americans and an Afghan soldier. You know, it's time and time again, you see the results. I mean, I talk about the results, the really lethal results of greed. And also, you know, one of my favorite stories and, you know, examples of all this is the Pacific Fleet. You know, the almighty barrier against China, you know, it's going to preserve freedom of the seas and, you know, enable us, stop the Chinese, you know, whatever, taking over the Pacific. Well, for years, the movements of that fleet in Asia, various ports it called on in Asia, were really dictated by a guy called Fat Leonard Francis, but everyone called him Fat Leonard. And he was a supply contractor. He would supply the fleet when it came into port with, you know, water and clean out the trash and all the rest. And he'd make a lot of money doing that if they called at the ports where he had his facilities. So he was bribing the entire upper echelon of the Pacific Fleet with fancy meals and cash and a team of prostitutes. He had a whole squad of prostitutes. They were known as the Thai SEAL team. And in the end, 60 admirals, count them, 60 admirals were under investigation for doing this for, you know, Fat Leonard. So we have, you know, we're told that we have this great threat, the Chinese. And what are we doing? We're moving the fleet around just because the admirals needed the services of a few Thai prostitutes. I mean, how it's squalid, you know, it's kind of squalid, but it shows that money, and I guess in this case, sex, was the driving force behind our so-called strategy.
Time for a break, and we'll be back in a few minutes. We're back with Sheer Intelligence and our guest. And the money is real. I mean, we shouldn't be light about it, you know, to spend 14, we were supposed to have a peace dividend. The first President Bush talked about cutting the military by 40%. You know, we don't have a Cold War. We don't have a Cold War enemy. In fact, we're trying to make Russia have a red scare, but they're not reds anymore. You know, Putin's the anti-red, if you actually look at their elections or anything. And the real threat would be a return of the Communist Party. So, but yet we managed with the end of the Cold War, instead of having a peace dividend, we managed to spend $14 trillion by the Pentagon since 9/11. And it's astounding. And if you think about it, 9/11 is an event that, for instance, had nothing to do with Iraq. It was the one country in the Middle East, you know, that where Al-Qaeda couldn't operate, or along with Israel, I guess. And Saddam Hussein was considered a secular leader, and, you know, bin Laden and those folks hated him. But, you know, we Saudi Arabia is a great arms purchaser. And so we ignore what 9/11 really was all about, and the example of a kind of lethal interpretation of the Muslim religion by some fanatics and fed basically by Saudi Arabia. And no, because we want to sell a lot of arms to Saudi Arabia. And one startling example where this plays out is picking a fight in Syria. And where in your book, you have some of the best discussion I've seen about, you know, cozying up to Islamic extremists, to Al-Qaeda and allied groups, including people like General Petraeus, saying, well, they're really not so bad. And why? Because they're anti-Assad, and Assad is backed by Russia. And that's an interesting thing. They don't even care about the elemental logic of their position.
Yeah.
Why don't you take us through the Syria thing and then maybe Ukraine? Because this, if we're going to have a new Cold War, it's got to be with a technologically competent power like Russia, or maybe China more likely now. And you know, because otherwise you can't really have, you know, in an Orwellian sense, the great enemy that will scare little children. And so so they're picking it in Syria with Russia, then Ukraine, and then you can go on to China. The hunt for a new enemy.
Right. Now, they've been talking about China. I mean, I'll go back to Syria in a second, but they've been talking about China right since the end of, since the Soviet Union collapsed. You know, they could see, I mean, there was a couple of years when, I remember when they talked about non-peer competitor. They were looking around. They didn't, you know, need an enemy in a hurry, but they couldn't quite sort of see who it was going to be for a minute. And then they, pretty soon, they started to talk about China. And then once we finished looting Russia, or even before we'd finished looting Russia, you know, they'd, as I said earlier, they'd broken the deal on Eastern Europe, expanded NATO. And so that ensured Russia could be an enemy again now. But on Syria, you know, it's pretty, well, it is so foul. This is the largest, you know, we've allied ourselves, having gone to war in Afghanistan and got, you know, the authorization for the use of military force to go and attack Afghanistan, and then to attack a whole bunch of other countries, and then to attack Syria, while allying, and the, you know, the original authorization was to get Al-Qaeda, right? They were our enemy. Al-Qaeda had attacked us. Al-Qaeda had, you know, attacked the trade towers and all, you know, the great outrage that launched all this. So what do? In Syria, because we don't like President Assad, we ally ourselves with Al-Qaeda. You know, we were shipping TOW missiles to, there was a kind of a cutout, which were the, something called the Free Syrian Army, which I think existed just to be a cutout. And they admitted, I mean, it was openly admitted that the weapons we were sending the Free Syrian Army were going straight to these Al-Qaeda units. I mean, they'd changed their name because they realized Al-Qaeda was, they couldn't actually call themselves Al-Qaeda. They gave themselves various cover names. So we have been fighting in Syria, supplying in what is the largest, considered the largest ever CIA operation in terms of money, to supply Al-Qaeda. I mean, how ridiculous is that? So that's kept one war going, and you know, with a huge benefit, particularly to the CIA, got an enormous budget out of it. Then we have Ukraine. What do we do in Ukraine? We have, they've been having elections since 1991, democratic elections, probably very corrupt elections, but we're no people, you know, we don't have much standing in that regard. So we have a freely elected president in Ukraine, Mr. Yanukovych. We don't like him because he isn't doing what he's told, and he could have made a deal with us or made a deal with Russia. This is in 2013, and he opts for Russia. So what do? We, you know, foment and, you know, send in or deploy all our efforts to destabilize him and drive it from office, which we did. I mean, no question of an election. We just did it. Then, you know, so now we're threatening to bring Ukraine into NATO, which is the whole plan. Putin reacts, not surprisingly. What did they expect? And we have a new, you know, so now we have a new front in the new Cold War in Ukraine. He takes Crimea and, you know, sends supports rebels in eastern Ukraine. So now we're sending, you know, now we got a good excuse to sell weapons to Ukraine. And, you know, that we do these, you know, very dangerous naval exercises off the side of Ukraine. But that's now we've got, you know, reignited the Cold War with Russia. That's humming along pretty well. But hey, there's a much bigger, you know, money pit available if you money pot available if we make China our big enemy. So, you know, now we're deploying huge forces or bigger and bigger forces in the Far East, expanding bases, appropriating more money to confront the Chinese. And by the way, what are we confronting the Chinese about? We're preserving the freedom of the seas so China can't interfere with, guess what, our trade with China. like the Chinese are going to suddenly stop all those shipments to Walmart and all the rest. So, you know, it's an endless cycle. And I want to make one thing clear. It's not like they really want war. I mean, if there is a war, they're going to make money out of it. But what's best of all is to have the threat of war or to pretend a threat of war so that you can then sort of, you know, start digging into the treasury and, you know, trousering the money.
Well, you know, it's interesting. If you read Orwell's 1984 again, they invent these enemies and so forth, and they're interchangeable. And then people say, well, that could never happen here because, of course, you know, we're sophisticated and we have a free press and so forth. And one of the things that's devastating in your book is your description of the intellectual establishment that supports the Defense Department, openly or covertly, for careerist reasons or out of belief. But they just buy all this crap. And the example of China is very good. First of all, now the good country in Asia is the country we try to obliterate under a democratic president, by the way, before Nixon, and you know, Vietnam. And everybody would like to start making iPhones in Vietnam more than in China, you know, but it's a smaller country and they're not as good at this. And so you have this great contradiction. And yet people look at it and commentators on these shows on MSNBC, as well as Fox and everything, talk about it all as plausible. It's all, oh, yes, oh, yes. It's wild. You know, in the case of Russia, you don't have a communist enemy, right? You have somebody who the U.S. helped put in power, Putin, you know, is the anti-communist person. And in China, what you have is an enemy because they're too good at capitalism. They're competitive. Yeah. it's not like they're, you know, invading other countries. What they're really doing is selling stuff, you know, and exploiting people on the market. You know, they're doing what old-fashioned capitalists were supposed to be able to do. So you have an absurdity on the face of it. And that's why I want to get back to your rubbing shoulders with these people. You go to these conferences. I should have mentioned the Washington bureau chief for Harper's Magazine. You've been inside this story forever. And how did he do it with a straight face? That's the part I don't get. Democrats and Republicans, by the way, you know, I also covered the Pentagon for many years, and I could never tell who was a Democrat and who was a Republican once you were inside that building.
Right. People complain, they like to sort of complain, saying the era of bipartisanship is over. Well, it's not, you know, there is great bipartisan consensus on, you know, shoveling money into the Pentagon. I mean, they do it for very rational reasons, which is, you know, they get money back, you know, in terms of the campaign contributions we know about, and even more the campaign contributions we don't know about, which, you know, there's a whole, that's a whole separate area of how money gets laundered in by the contractors and by the lobbyists and everything else. I mean, I tell a story in the book, which was the day after Putin took over Crimea, okay? There was a meeting of defense lobbyists, and it was a fundraiser, breakfast fundraiser for an important congressman. And there was a meeting of these were represent the lobbyists for all the big defense contractors were there. It's in an office in K Street. And a friend of mine happened to be there, and I said, he was one of the lobbyists, and I said, oh, wow, that was pretty. He said, you know, I was having lunch with him that day. He said where he'd been. I said, oh, pretty interesting. I mean, what was the mood? And he'd say, I call it borderline euphoria. They were all so thrilled that, you know, now, you know, Putin had taken over Crimea, this was going to really jack up our defense budget. You know, the news was good. Happy days are here again. And that's, you know, and by the way, this is a, you know, I think this applies all sides. I think, you know, the Russians and the Chinese, they have their own defense lobbies. I mean, this is a universal construct we have here. But, you know, in my book, I talk about the US and, again, you know, how the, you know, there's a very amazing fact I came across in writing the book, which is the defense budget has gone up overall at a steady rate of 5% a year since 1954. I mean, so it dips up and down, but the mean is that 5%. And here's what's interesting is whenever it dips below that 5%, looks like it's, you know, really heading down, there's an immediate reaction. There's a new threat. You know, Eisenhower was going at the end of Eisenhower's years, because Eisenhower was fed up with the Pentagon, and it was going down. So the reaction is you get John F. Kennedy, you know, promising, you know, talking about a missile gap and, you know, quickly, you know, jacking up the defense budget. At the end of Vietnam, end of major war in Asia, you know, 500,000 troops have all come home, don't need to bomb the place anymore, or can't bomb the place anymore. You expect, so the defense budget did go down briefly. So what happened? There was an immediate reaction. Hey, the Russians, they're much more powerful than we thought. Oh my God, they're building more civil defense shelters and bigger missiles, better missiles. We need to raise defense funding. And sure enough, it went up again. And so, you know, it keeps happening. And I've come to think of the Pentagon, the whole war, you know, military industrial complex. It's like some primitive organism, like an amoeba or a virus that exists only to feed itself and grow. So whenever the food supply looks like it's going to be cut off, like by something terrible like peace, you know, disappearance of a threat, it quickly reacts and sort of, you know, reestablishes its food supply. And I think that's how we got to think about it. And it's a malignant virus. And that's, we've got to think of it in those terms.
Well, you know, I think the interesting thing, however, is, you know, let's get back to capitalism. I think a classical economist knew that conquering other lands was a loser. There was ample evidence in that in all the preceding empires. And the whole, really, the issue is, right now, the odd thing is that as America becomes increasingly incompetent in producing things that the rest of the world wants to buy, that, you know, you can't buy. I bought a GM car, the Bolt, the electric car, and I was shocked to look at the sticker and find out that something like only 30% of it was made here and in Canada. You know, it's so we have this odd situation where in our hunt, and this I get back to Orwell, in our hunt to find the enemy, it's very difficult to find a good fit. You know, we're not willing to take on Saudi Arabia and, you know, those people because they write such big checks to us. You got in Russia a country that, you know, As you point out in your book, they're increasingly difficult for them to maintain their military. Clearly, it's a failed economy in basic ways. And, you know, and the non-communists, the ex-communists are in charge. If Russia, you know, Putin gets destabilized and overthrown, it'd probably be people who call themselves communists who come back to power. And the irony is that so Russia doesn't really work. You know, not that that would stop them. They picked on Grenada once. But then you have China. How do we start a war with China? I mean, suddenly all of the toys that keep Americans amused are gone. You know, China underwrites our debt. China invests in real estate in the United States. So you have a very weird situation. You and I were raised on a big battle about ideology, left, right. Well, two things that have been clear. The Democrats are, if anything, better warmongers than the Republicans, and that includes Trump. Trump had a lot of bravado and rhetoric. He didn't actually start any wars, you know, and actually was accused of cozying up to some of these folks. And you have somebody, I want to maybe end this. Tell me about Victoria Nuland. And I think I read in your book, she's married to Robert Kagan, who was one of the big neocons. And she somehow survives, and she's now right there in the Biden administration in a very big way, making policy. And she's the one that had a lot to do with the mischief that almost got us into a war with Russia over the Ukraine.
Yeah, and it's a perfect example. You know, I talked earlier about bipartisanship. And Victoria, or Toria, as you know, they call her in Washington. She's the living, breathing example in a sort of horrible way of this. I mean, she, you know, I first heard of her when she was a foreign policy advisor to Dick Cheney. Actually, before that, she worked for Strobe Talbot, who was this sidekick of Bill Clinton. Then she became, you know, so suddenly the Democrats are out and, you know, evil Republicans are in. And gosh, who's that? Victoria Nuland. She's advising Dick Cheney. And then you have Obama. Oh, wait a minute. Where's Victoria? Who's that as the chief spokesman for the State Department? Oh, Victoria Nuland again. And then what is she? She's Assistant Secretary for Europe. And in that respect,
with Hillary Clinton in the State Department.
With her under Hillary Clinton. And what is she doing? Well, as thanks to a very interesting leaked, first tapped, hacked, and then leaked phone call, she was in Ukraine deciding, you know, basically supervising a coup, you know, the ejection of Mr. Yanukovych, the admittedly corrupt, but also democratically elected president of Ukraine. And they were deciding who to... she was, you know, the phone calls with the American ambassador in Ukraine, and they were sort of standing around discussing who it was they were going to put in as prime minister. You know, the Europeans had one guy, but we don't like him much. We're going to put in our guy. And then a word I can't use on the air, I guess, you know, do it to the EU. Nuland's, you know, mission accomplished. Ukraine, or at least the western half of Ukraine, has been peeled away from the Russian orbit, and now we're getting ready to bring it into NATO and do what NATO countries do, which is to buy American weapons. That's the main function of NATO, as I hope people realize by now, and they certainly should do after reading my book. And so then, then comes in the, you know, awful Trump, and weapons sales to Ukraine go on, of course, but Nuland has gone off to pasture in some think tank somewhere. Then, great, wicked Trump has gone. In comes Biden, promising new broom, overhaul, reform, you know, light and joy has returned. Who is number three in the State Department? Victoria Nuland. Oh, my God. You know, so, all eager to make sure we... you know, have a state of perpetual cold war and tension and prospect of nuclear immolation. That's her job.
Yes, as the old great Marine Commander Smedley Butler said, war is a racket, and these people are good at it. Let me conclude this, however, by taking it up to the present, because we talked about the old-fashioned military contractors, Raytheon and Lockheed. Mm-hmm. But there's a new breed of the high tech, and actually they've been along, you know, Google itself. The whole internet really came out of the Defense Department.
Yeah.
It was a way of keeping up communication in the event of all-out nuclear war. So you had to have decentralization, and you know, these packets and cells and everything. And that's how, where we got the internet and the idea of it. And Google has been up to its eyeballs with the defense industry, you know, from the beginning. And you know, take a company like Amazon, which just lost the competition with Microsoft under the Trump administration to build the huge cloud for all the intelligence agencies and for the Pentagon. And they, you know, then they got a big piece of it anyway. And you could write down, you have a company like Palantir that's dealing with or leading the surveillance of American people through our local police departments. Their only client was the CIA for the first 3 years of their business, and the CIA was an investor through InQtel. So you have, in the modern Silicon Valley world, you have a connection there with the military-industrial complex that is every bit as tight as the old-fashioned airplane and steel industries.
Well, that's right, because why, you know, how can any corporate CEO, whether it's, you know, something all sort of new and shiny like a, you know, a tech company, or you know, just as much as any old, something old-fashioned like a steel company, you know, you know, it's Willie Sutton and the banks. That's where the money is. I mean, how are you going to tell, you know, the contract that Amazon and Microsoft were fighting over, the Pentagon cloud contract, that was $10 billion. You know, so there, it's late, you know, you can call it what you like, late capitalism or something, when really more and more the way to make money, make serious money, even if you're already making a lot of money like the tech companies, is the public purse. You know, it's a license to loot. And who's going to pass that up?
Well, we could end on that, but let me throw in one little concern here or issue here, because most of the time this is all justified, as you point out in your book, by some appeal to human rights. You know, we must go to war with China now because of the Uyghurs, or because of previously what happened to Tibet, or because of how they treat their population one way or another. And that's always the refrain. And it strikes me that the biggest human right violation, certain terms of numbers of people, go back to a very simple old idea of the exploitation of labor. And China, if you were going to make a human rights criticism of China, it would seem to me you would begin with, surprisingly, in a country that came to power, you know, party came to power championing workers' rights, do Chinese workers have the right to form real unions? Do they have worker protection? Can they go on strike? Can they find a political voice? All of the things that we saw in other capitalist societies providing some hope of improvement and what have you. And it's ironic. We keep criticizing China for everything except the main thing that we are partners in, which is that they create most of the consumer products that we use. Our whole prosperity, particularly during this pandemic, our ability to survive in this pandemic, the masks, everything that was shipped out by Amazon and everything else, almost all of it was produced in China by workers that have a real human rights problem. And you never hear a word about that.
No.
Well, how do they do it with a straight face? That's the part I don't get. You know, I don't get it. Then you, okay, let's just end on that. You hang out with these people. Now, a number of them have gone to, you know, the Harvards and Oxfords of this world. They're educated like you are. Many of them are at universities getting big defense contracts. Everybody's forgotten that. These universities get a lot of that money. It's not just Raytheon. And yet, you know, we don't have an anti-war movement of any significance. And nobody's calling them out. We have a culture of support for this military larceny and murder. It's supported very widely, not just at sporting events where we honor the troops, et cetera, but by most of our intellectual class and most of our news media. They're in on it. and they do it with a straight face. What happens when you ask them? Do you ever bring up to them why couldn't the troops in Iraq have proper goggles and helmets? What's going on? Yeah. Well, what happens? What's the short answer they give you? Too good to check?
Oh, we're working on that. Yeah, there's been a glitch in the system. I remember making a big fuss when I was doing a story about when all our troops were being blown up by IEDs in Iraq and then Afghanistan. And I went into that in depth. It was a while ago. And they were using it as an excuse to spend, hundreds of billions of dollars on tens of billions of dollars anyway on anti-IED technology, none of which worked. And I would say, well, none of this works. There are simple things you could be doing. Why don't you do it? And they'd say, oh, well, you're just me being negative. Of course, this is the way to do it. And they'd shut me down. They'd say I have my figures wrong. They were spending $100,000 an hour flying a plane that would detect and sort of prematurely explode IEDs. And I got hold of a secret intelligence report which had looked at the record of this thing, and it said it had, quote, no detectable effect on the thing. And I would throw this at them, and they would say, it's wrong. No, that's bad data. They would just lie. That's the basic thing.
So it's just a generalized corruption.
Yeah.
Again, getting back to general, then turn President Eisenhower, the corruptions of power and the military-industrial complex. He wanted to put the word congressional in, and he also was thinking about the universities. He did mention how much of research and so forth is directed and underwritten by the Pentagon. That's all of the corruption we have time for today. I want to thank Christopher Ho, KCRW, for posting these shows, Joshua Scheer, our executive producer, Natasha Hakimi Zapata, who does the intro, Lucy Berger, who does the transcription, and the JWK Foundation in the memory of Gene Stein, a terrific writer and journalist, for helping keep these shows going. See you next week with another edition of Scheer Intelligence.